This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor for Tuesday, August the 18th, 2026. As is my custom, we'll start in the World section of today's Monitor and work our way through as many sections and articles as we can in the time that we have together. So, to start us off from the World section, the first headline reads, Why Trump Ordered the Pentagon to Slash Joint Exercises with South Korea. President Donald Trump's announcement that he is scaling back U.S. participation in longstanding joint military drills in South Korea shows Washington's willingness to turn away from traditional allies. The date on this article is August the 18th. It is by Matthew Bell, who is a staff writer at the Monitor. Annual U.S.-South Korea military exercises kicked off Monday in the shadow of a surprise announcement from President Donald Trump that signaled shifting U.S. tactics in the Pacific. In a social media post Sunday evening, Mr. Trump said he was ordering the Pentagon to scale back on drills aimed at deterring military aggression by North Korea. He said it was too late to cancel them altogether, but that he was, quote, not happy with U.S. participation in annual military exercises that go back decades. The president also criticized South Korea for not joining the U.S. war against Iran. Mr. Trump said his decision was, quote, based on my very good relationship with Kim Jong-un, the North Korean dictator whom he met with three times during his first term. Trump has been clear about his desire to meet Kim again, says Victor Cha of Georgetown University, who also served as President George W. Bush's top advisor on North Korean affairs. Scaling down of the joint military exercises is the latest signal. What's different this time is that it is a concrete action rather than just words and social media posts. It was not immediately clear to what extent this year's exercises would be limited. The United States has more than 28,000 troops stationed in South Korea. Regarding the drills, one of the top UN commanders on the peninsula, Australian Lieutenant General Scott Winter, said last week that this year's would be, quote, bigger and better than ever. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff report that exercises began as scheduled. A statement issued by South Korea's presidential Blue House on Monday said it was reviewing Mr. Trump's announcement and, quote, hopes that the friendly relationship between the U.S. and North Korean leaders will lead to meaningful dialogue aimed at advancing peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula, end quote. But some experts say South Korean leaders must be frustrated with the way this has played out at a time when the alliance with the United States has come under strain. I think the announcement was a slap in the face for Seoul, says Rachel Min-Young Lee, a senior fellow with the Stimson Center's Korea Program and 38 North. Alongside the tariffs that President Trump has imposed on South Korea, Ms. Lee says this episode will end up further eroding U.S. credibility as a reliable security partner for South Korea. The government in North Korea, meanwhile, has long complained that annual U.S. South Korean military exercises demonstrate hostility toward Pyongyang. On Friday, its foreign ministry called the drills, scheduled to run through August 27th, a rehearsal for an aggressive war. The U.S. president might also be trying to draw Mr. Kim away from Russian leader Vladimir Putin as North Korea expands its role in Russia's war against Ukraine, says Professor Cha. But Kim may not be interested in meeting until after the midterms to gain some additional leverage, he says. There could be one other factor behind the president's decision, Professor Cha adds. Trump may want to change the headlines from Iran to something else. And once again, this particular article was written by, let me get back up to the top here, by Matthew Bell, who is a staff writer at the Monitor. Continuing on to our second headline in today's World section of the Monitor, this one reads, With war slowing, Saudi food imports, hydroponics, With war slowing Saudi food imports, hydroponics provide a homegrown solution. Hydroponic farms in import-reliant Saudi Arabia are good for business and for national security as well. With the arid kingdom facing blockades and disruptions on both its coasts, growing food in water, surprisingly, is providing a green line of defense. The date on this article is August the 17th. It is by Taylor Luck, who is a special correspondent at the Monitor. And the dateline is Al-Kharj, Saudi Arabia. Growing in water tubes across Saudi Arabia are the roots of the kingdom's Iran-proof future. In the August heat of the central Saudi desert, by all accounts, these vegetables should not be growing cherry tomatoes, bell peppers, kale. With daytime highs of 125 degrees dropping to only 91 degrees overnight, growth slows at traditional farms. Cucumbers turn bitter, tomatoes flower, shrivel, leaves wilt, and pests such as white flies and spider mites run rampant across the field. Saudi farmers need tens of thousands of gallons of water per day just for a fraction of their crops to survive outside of date palms, so most farmers don't bother growing in the summer. But not in Dhaba. In the farm's cooled greenhouses an hour south of Riyadh, vegetables are growing and fast without soil. See how big and ripe these are? Dhaba operations manager Lehiani Ali says excitedly, picking out an orange grape tomato from a recently packed carton. Some people won't believe this is from Saudi. In the kingdom, farmers are increasingly turning to hydroponic methods, growing fruits and vegetables indoors without soil by placing their roots in nutrient-enriched water. It has been more than good business, but also good for national security. In import-heavy Saudi Arabia, facing wartime blockades and disruptions on both coasts, hydroponic farms like Dhaba and others are growing a green line of defense. Saudi Arabia, a country of 35 million, imports the bulk of its food needs, including 70% of its fruits and vegetables from India, Russia, the United States, and Europe. That figure reaches nearly 100% during the summer months. The perishable fruits and vegetables were long imported through the Strait of Hormuz to Saudi Arabia's eastern coast, now closed by dueling blockades and Iranian demands to extract tolls. With Hormuz blocked, Saudi Arabia has been redirecting shipments to its Red Sea port of Jeddah. But this route requires 10 to 14 more days of transit to reach distribution centers and has become increasingly susceptible to attacks from Yemen's Iran-allied Houthi group. But in the local markets in Riyadh, one can frequently find a product immune to the wartime closures, Saudi-grown vegetables. Since 2022, Dhaba has turned to hydroponic farming in a plot of land in Al-Kharj, an arid area with nutrient-rich soil known for its date palms. In the heat of summer, it remains a comfortable 80 to 82 degrees Fahrenheit in their greenhouses with solar panels to help power the cooling. In its 210 acres of glass hydroponic greenhouses, Dhaba produces 135 tons per day of tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, lettuce, and herbs. After scaling up the past few years, the farm now provides Saudi Arabia with 13% of its tomato needs. Dhaba plans to reach 250 tons of produce per day by 2028 and 1,000 tons by 2030, and establish renewable energy resources generating 15 megawatts of electricity to power it. With the soilless controlled conditions, Dhaba farmers say they use up to 80% less water and 70% less land, key for a kingdom where water is scarce and desertification is shrinking arable lands. The hydroponic system allows us to grow vegetables and fruits where most farms can't, and save water, says Wissam Abdel Samad, Dhaba deputy CEO, in a bustling office looking out at the nursery. We're not only helping fulfill the Saudi vision for food security, but we are working in an extremely hot climate in a susceptible in a sustainable way that creates quality produce. This soilless treatment allows farmers to provide the exact amount of nutrients and water needed without runoff while recycling most of the water, key in arid Saudi Arabia, one of the most water-scarce countries in the world. The kingdom is the largest single desalinator of seawater, producing 790 billion gallons per year and relying on it for 60% of its potable needs. The U.S.-Iran war exposed these dual vulnerabilities, reliance on imported food and desalination, with both blockades and attempts by Iran and its proxies in neighboring Yemen and Iraq to strike the kingdom's desalination and power plants. More Saudis are catching on. Saudi Arabia Hydroponics runs a farm in eastern Saudi Arabia using floating systems and aeroponics to produce hundreds of tons of vegetables, fruits, and leafy greens, such as kale, cutting down their water usage by 90%. The Saudi firm, along with its South Korean partners, says it is also providing technology and building hydroponic greenhouses for other Saudi farmers who are increasingly turning to the technology to adapt and boost yields in the ever-heating climate. The country's media regularly highlights Saudi farmers adopting hydroponic farming on news shows. And amid the current war, Dawa has increased exports overland to Saudi Arabia's Gulf neighbors, who import 100% of their own fruit and vegetable needs, and recently began exporting Saudi vegetables to the Netherlands, marking the first Saudi vegetables ever sold to Europe. Saudi Arabia has gone from importing produce from Europe to exporting Saudi produce to Europe, says Mr. Abdel Samad. It is a long path to food security, but our roots are growing. And once again, this particular article is by Taylor Luck, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. Still from the world section of today's Monitor, our next headline reads, Guatemala's Next Chapter, How Change in the Public Prosecutor's Office Raises Hope for Democracy. After 8 years defined by corruption and impunity in the public prosecutor's office, can a new attorney general put Guatemala back on track? The date on this article is August the 17th. It is by Juliana Ramazzini, who is a contributor at The Monitor, and the dateline is Guatemala City. When Gabriel Garcia Luna took office as Guatemala's Attorney General in May, it was a pivot away from years of internationally condemned corruption in the public prosecutor's office and signaled an opportunity to rebuild. 3 months in, Mr. Garcia Luna has already started to clean house. But just how radically he can walk back the corruption that plagued this office over the past 8 years and its meddling in the stewardship of Guatemala's president will continue to be tested. Guatemala's former chief prosecutor, Maria Consuelo Porras, was accused of gutting the public prosecutor's office of career lawyers, undermining anti-corruption efforts, and chipping away at democracy and the rule of law. She took steps to keep anti-corruption president Bernardo Arevalo out of office, and many point to her role in complicating his political projects. She was sanctioned for corruption by more than 40 countries, including the United States. Mr. Garcia Luna has ousted Ms. Porras' key allies, and he has launched a committee to review cases of those criminalized under her administration. His office is working closely with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which scheduled an early August hearing to review cases of individuals who denounced political persecution under Ms. Porras. It's giving some, such as Juan Francisco Sandoval, a former head of Guatemala's Special Prosecutor's Office Against Impunity, FECI, and who was pushed into exile by Ms. Porras' office, cautious hope that the public could one day regain confidence in the justice system here. This closes a phase marked by the deterioration and manipulation of the justice system, Mr. Sandoval says. Credibility has been restored. There was a time when the public prosecutor's office was an institution that inspired the most public trust. We all have high expectations for Mr. Garcia Luna. Guatemala was once seen as a regional model for tackling corruption through its International Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala, or CICIG, which countries such as El Salvador and Honduras tried to emulate. The commission, which operated from 2007 to 2019, was backed by the United Nations and worked alongside Guatemalan prosecutors to investigate organized crime, corruption, and illicit networks. As it investigated increasingly powerful business people and politicians, including a sitting president and vice president, some critics feared it was overstepping its mandate, becoming too influential in domestic politics. When Ms. Porras took over as Attorney General in 2018, she didn't have a close relationship with CICIG leadership. A year later, its charter was not renewed by the Guatemalan government. Ms. Porras conducted investigations aimed at criminalizing judges, prosecutors, journalists, and human rights defenders, at least 79 of whom were living in exile by 2023 due to fears of unjust imprisonment. That same year, she launched what the Organization of American States described as, quote, an attempted coup against Mr. Arevalo to keep him from taking office. He ran on a pro-democracy platform, blaming the country's widespread corruption for hollowing out the state's ability to deliver security, justice, education, and economic opportunities. Ms. Porras tried to hold on to a position of power before her second consecutive term as Attorney General expired this year, unsuccessfully running for a seat on the Constitutional Court, as well as a third term as Attorney General. On May 15th, Mr. Garcia Luna was sworn in as Guatemala's new top prosecutor. Mr. Garcia Luna took office with the eyes of the entire country upon him. A career judge, he previously served as a criminal law advisor to the Office of the Solicitor General and president of the nation's Judicial Disciplinary Board. Everyone has a concept of a public prosecutor's office that can be used in a certain way, and we can no longer have that, he told the Associated Press in July. It is not a political entity nor a political weapon for anyone, and I do not intend to repeat the actions taken in previous administrations. Though Mr. Luna's appointment feels like the end of a difficult period for Guatemala's democracy, his most revolutionary work might be the baseline task of getting the nation back on track to follow and trust the rule of law, experts say. Mr. Garcia Luna is now at the helm of the most important institution of repression, says Edgar Ortiz Romero, an expert in constitutional law, referring to the public prosecutor's office. He has the task of dismantling that mechanism of repression and reorienting it toward what it should be about, justice and public safety. Already, Mr. Garcia Luna has closed FEIC, the Special Office on Impunity, which had become politicized under Ms. Porras' leadership. He also dismissed at least 8 high-profile prosecutors closely aligned with the former attorney general. Mr. Sandoval warns that there are no quick fixes to the challenges of the public prosecutor's office. Many prosecutors and specialized investigators left their jobs under Ms. Porras, and the office has been weakened, he says. Claudia Paz y Paz, who served as Attorney General from 2010 to 2014 and went into exile in 2024 for fear of being criminalized by the public prosecutor's office, says a 4-year term as Attorney General might not be enough time to fix all of its challenges. But, she says, it's enough time to make progress on the things that are most important. For the nearly 3 years that Mr. Arevalo has been in office, his efforts to create change in the country, such as filing corruption complaints or trying to replace Ms. Porras, were repeatedly spoiled by intervention or investigations by the public prosecutor's office. Many, including members of Guatemala's more than 22 Maya indigenous groups that were key in bringing Mr. Arevalo to the presidency, are hopeful Mr. Garcia Luna's appointment could spell broader changes in the country. But it wasn't just Ms. Porras getting in the president's way, observers say. Mr. Arevalo has no formal governing coalition in the legislature. His Movimiento Semilla party lost its legal registration as a political party this year and is barred from participating in 2027 general elections. He was able to pass for some reforms, including anti-money laundering legislation and ethics reforms within the executive branch, but a lot of his energy has been focused on preserving democratic institutions under repeated legal challenges from his porous team. Public opinion for the president is low, with some 52% of Guatemalans qualifying his work thus far as bad or very bad, according to a May poll by CID Gallup. In that sense, Mr. Garcia Luna's appointment might be too little too late to clear governing hurdles for the president, says Mr. Ortiz, the constitutional law expert. Obviously, I think the way Arevalo can govern will change because there will be less repression, he says, but the chances of making major changes were in the first year, not the third. And once again, this particular article was by Juliana Ramazzini, who is a contributor at The Monitor. Still in the world section, our next article reads, top military commander visits long-deployed aircraft carrier. U.S. troops have been deployed on the USS Abraham Lincoln for a record 240 days. Admiral Brad Cooper visited the sailors amid reports of deteriorating mental health. The date on this article is August the 16th. It is by the Associated Press. The top U.S. military commander in the Middle East praised the leadership of the long-deployed USS Lincoln after visiting the sailors on the vessel during a regional tour that ended on Saturday, the U.S. Central Command said. U.S. negotiator Jared Kushner had a rare meeting with the Hamas leader on the Gaza ceasefire. And the 60-day negotiating period that began with the June 17th signing of an interim agreement between the U.S. and Iran is set to end with no word of an extension. Here's a look at the latest developments on Sunday in the Iran war and the wider Middle East. So, first, the visit of the U.S. Central Command Chief to the aircraft carrier. Admiral Brad Cooper visited the USS Lincoln as reports have emerged of mental health and supply issues. The Lincoln arrived in the Middle East in January and has been supporting the U.S. war against Iran, including the blockade on Iranian ports. It has spent a record-setting uninterrupted time at sea of more than 240 days. History will record this deployment as one of the most operationally intense and consequential of the modern era, Admiral Cooper said of the Lincoln Strike Group in a statement released Saturday. Extended deployments of carriers, which can have more than 5,000 sailors and Marines on board, have raised concerns. In a statement Sunday, Mr. Cooper praised the leadership on the carrier for making mental health and resiliency a priority. Mr. Cooper also went to Bahrain, Iraq, Israel, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates to meet with civilian and military leaders, according to the Central Command statement. The U.S. Navy's blockade is in response to Iran's asserting control over the Strait of Hormuz after the war started on February 28th with the U.S. and Israeli strikes. Before then, about one-fifth of the world's traded oil and natural gas passed through what has been considered an international waterway. Talks between the U.S. and Iran have stalled while Iran talks with Oman about how to manage the strait that runs between them. And also going on in the Middle East, the U.S. negotiator meets with the Hamas chief. U.S. negotiator and President Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, held a rare meeting with the Hamas chief in a new diplomatic effort to make progress in the stalled Gaza ceasefire. Mr. Kushner will meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, met with him yesterday. The meeting in Egypt with Hamas Khalil al-Haya was confirmed by a regional official and a Hamas official, both speaking on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to talk to reporters. Mr. Kushner was one of a trio of envoys meeting with al-Haya, with officials from mediating countries Egypt, Qatar, and Turkey also attending. Mediators are pushing for the implementation of a roadmap that calls for the disarmament of Hamas and other Palestinian militant groups in Gaza, the withdrawal of Israeli forces, and the handing over of power to Palestinian technocrats. Mr. Netanyahu has rejected Mr. Trump's latest plan to advance the stalled ceasefire, saying Israel will not withdraw from any of the roughly 60% of the territory it controls until Hamas has been completely disarmed, something the militant group controlling the rest has resisted. Mr. Kushner, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, and the director of the U.S.-created Board of Peace overseeing the ceasefire, Nikolay Mladenov, are meeting with Mr. Netanyahu on Monday, according to a person familiar with the plans and a diplomat who both spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss a closed-door meeting. Separately, Mr. Kushner met with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. The president's office said the meeting called for Israel and Hamas to fulfill their obligations under the ceasefire agreement in the Gaza Strip without elaborating. Also happening in the Middle East, Israel targets two Hezbollah commanders in last Saturday's strikes. Israel's military said it targeted two Hezbollah commanders in Saturday's strikes in southern Lebanon, the deadliest attack since a truce between Israel and Iran-backed Hezbollah went into effect in June. Lebanon's health ministry and state news agency said at least 11 people were killed. Israel's military said early Sunday one strike killed Abu Hassan Ala, whom it describes as a senior Hezbollah commander who had taken part in attacks against Israel soldiers in southern Lebanon. Earlier, the military said a strike killed Ali Samir al-Haj Hassan, also described as a Hezbollah commander, adding that his family was with him. Israel and the Lebanese government announced a framework agreement in June, laying out a plan for Israeli forces to withdraw from southern Lebanon in exchange for Hezbollah's disarmament. Hezbollah has refused direct talks and wasn't party to the U.S.-mediated deal. Next, also in the Middle East, Iran insists Qatar is holding three of its pilots. Iran again on Sunday alleged that Qatar was holding three Iranian pilots who were missing in March when their jets were downed, which Qatar has denied. Iran State TV reported Sunday that the commander of the Missing Persons Committee of Iran's Armed Forces, General Staff, has urged Qatar to allow Iranian Air Force experts to conduct a field investigation. This is the first known case in the war where Iran has said a regional country is holding its fighters. Tehran has repeatedly targeted regional countries that are hosting U.S. military bases. And again, in the Middle East, an Israeli strike in Gaza wounds five. An Israeli strike hit Khan Yunis in southern Gaza and wounded five people, including a child who was seriously injured, according to the Kuwaiti and Nasser hospitals, where the casualties were taken. Israel's military said it struck a member of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. While the heaviest fighting has subsided since a ceasefire took hold in October between Israel and Hamas, Israeli forces have carried out repeated airstrikes, killing at least 1,262 Palestinians, according to Gaza's health ministry. The ministry, part of the Hamas-led government, maintains detailed casualty records that are seen as generally reliable by the UN. And once again, this is a compilation report by the Associated Press. And here's one final headline from today's World section of the Monitor for you. It reads, "These Afghan women in Europe aim to bring change to their home country." Displaced Afghans from the world's, quote, worst women's rights crisis leverage education for their new lives in Europe. The date on this article is August the 15th. It is by Dominique Sogoy, who is a special correspondent at the Monitor. And the dateline is Aarau, Switzerland. On August 15, 2021, the future that Mariam had been building for herself as a student at Kabul University collapsed. News the Taliban had seized the Afghan capital spread fast through text messages urging students to flee the campus. It was a big shock. Everyone went home or to the airport, says Mariam, who's in her mid-20s, sipping an iced matcha outside a library in the Swiss city of Aarau. The library offers both an escape from the single room she shares and an asylum center here, and the quiet she needs to study German. Mariam is one of three Afghan women now resettled in Europe the Monitor spoke with for this story. Each started from scratch here in the West, and each of them has never stopped hoping for change back home. Two are being identified with pseudonyms out of concern for the safety of relatives in Afghanistan. The Taliban takeover of Afghanistan 5 years ago ushered in an era of dehumanizing restriction for women and girls. Simply being a woman from that country is enough to be granted asylum in some European countries, including Denmark and the Netherlands. Most of the world's 2.6 million registered Afghan refugees are in Iran and Pakistan. In 2021, following the Taliban's rise to power, Afghans submitted 102,000 asylum applications in the European Union, more than double the previous year. In 2025, they lodged nearly 64,000 first-time asylum applications and another 6,207 in Switzerland. The Taliban have stripped women and girls of their rights and dignity, says Shaharzad Akbar, executive director of Rawah Dari, an Afghan human rights organization. This situation has led to mass exodus of educated and professional women from Afghanistan. Leaving Afghanistan is not easy, particularly for single women, and Europe has become less welcoming to Afghan refugees in recent years. But the continent has offered the kind of education that was taken from women at home, and that many see as a tool of both resistance and preparation for a future they still want to help shape in their home country. German is not the first foreign language that Miriam has tackled in pursuit of a better future. By the time Kabul fell to the Taliban, she had completed 6 semesters of Chinese alongside a cohort of about 30 university students who believed that their best prospects for jobs and scholarships would come from the East. Before the Taliban came to power, there were many opportunities for girls, recalls Mariam, who belongs to the Farsi-speaking Hazara minority of Afghanistan. That soon changed. Female students were first required to wear hijabs with colorful headscarves tolerated for a while. Then only black was allowed, and full face covering became mandatory. By December 2022, women were banned from campus altogether. As of June 2026, the Taliban had issued 166 decrees specifically targeting the rights of women and girls, according to the Georgetown Institute for Women, Peace, and Security. Afghanistan is the worst women's rights crisis in the world, says Fereshta Abbasi, a researcher in the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch, pointing out that Afghanistan is the only nation in the world where women and girls are barred from secondary and higher education. Today, Mariam hopes speaking German will pave the way for a bachelor's degree. She carries the pain of separation from her husband and parents, who are still in Kabul. Her sisters contact her from there constantly. Freedom for Mariam takes shape in simple pleasures. At the top of the list is taking the train to discover different parts of Switzerland and learning to ride a scooter. Back in Kabul, she would be confined to her family's home or the city's sole park designated only for single women. The best part is that I have my freedom here and I have my hope, she says. I hope I can find something that can help not just my sisters, but all the girls in Afghanistan. They, too, have their hopes. Sitara grew up in Afghanistan's cultural capital of Herat, where her mother, who married at age 13 and never attended school, was her constant companion. Though illiterate, she sat by Sitara as her child learned the alphabet and stayed up late to cook and keep her company when she finally reached university. I wish I had had this opportunity, she often told Sitara, who went on to become a teacher. Violence drove Sitara from Afghanistan. Taliban fighters gunned down one of her brothers in the street in retaliation for a rejected marriage proposal. She flew to the country of Georgia with her sister and continued to Greece. Finding little support there, Sitara sought better conditions in Switzerland, only to be moved through 7 prison-like camps and deported back to Greece under EU asylum rules. Over the past 5 years, Europe's political debate has shifted away from resettlement and toward returns. Brussels recently hosted a Taliban delegation in June for migration talks, and Germany has sent 4 deportation flights to Afghanistan, deporting 154 Afghans between August 2024 and April 2026. Now more settled in Athens, Sitara paints landscapes in her free time. Through church, she has gained the freedom to openly practice the Christianity that she first encountered in Afghanistan. She also studies economy and management on a scholarship and helps guide migrants through the asylum process. "I have deep empathy because I went through many of these challenges," Sitara said. She wants to create an organization that helps refugees rebuild their lives. She urges others to see displaced Afghans, particularly Afghan women, as more than victims or burdens to society. "They are qualified to work, learn languages, become part of communities, and contribute," she said. "Hope is gone from my country. Darkness has taken over Afghanistan. This country has become a prison for every Afghan girl." UNICEF estimates that more than 3 million Afghan girls were shut out of secondary education in 2021. Close to half are unlikely to return should school reopen today, the agency concluded in a report published after the first year of Taliban rule. For Mursal, an Afghan student at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, getting an education is a responsibility toward those who were denied the same chance. "I'm going to open a path for my siblings, for my cousins, for my community," she said. "My grandma was always encouraging me to focus on my education, stand on my own feet, don't be dependent on anyone else, especially men," she recalls. "If you don't rely on yourself as a woman, anyone who provides for you will also control all aspects of your life." Gender-based restrictions appeared in her life at age nine. They included abandoning outside playtime with friends in favor of household chores. She says her grandfather was loving enough to walk her to private school in Kabul. "I think that was the only privilege that I had in Afghanistan," she says. Mursal was a teenager when she arrived in Glasgow in August 2021. A series of violent attacks persuaded her father that Afghanistan was not safe for his daughters. He left first to begin a new life for the family in the United Kingdom. In Scotland, it was back to square one. Her Afghan high school qualifications were not recognized. "I struggled a lot," she says, "to adjust to the Scottish accent and make her way to university, where she now goes to class with native English speakers. But when you are so determined to achieve something, you will do it no matter what." Afghanistan is never far from her mind. One day, scrolling through social media, she saw the devastating images of an attack at her old school. I realized my seat," she said. "I couldn't do anything except cry." Mursal says life in exile has made her conscious of which Afghan values she wants to preserve. Hospitality and respect for elders are obvious keepers. Religious and cultural restrictions for girls are not. She says she is grateful her parents embraced her independence, including by allowing her to live in another city. When it comes to the future of Afghan girls, she says what worries her is that the Taliban mindset will outlast its control over the government. "It takes lots of time and effort to change that thinking," she says. "We can achieve it by people who have the opportunity to leave the country, be in a safe place, educate themselves, and then maybe, hopefully, we can do something for Afghanistan." And again, this particular article was by Dominique Sogoy, who is a special correspondent at The Monitor. With that, we're going to move right along to the USA section of today's Monitor and pick up a couple of articles. Our first headline reads, "Big Beautiful Bill was top GOP achievement. Now, it's campaign fodder for Democrats." The Republicans' signature 2025 legislation was expected to be a key campaign advantage, but public opinion and outcry over its cuts are turning it into a liability. The date on this article is August the 18th. It is by Caitlin Babcock, who is a staff writer at the Monitor, and the dateline is Washington, D.C. About a year ago, the White House touted its One Big Beautiful Bill Act as the biggest legislation win of President Donald Trump's second term. The bill, commonly referred to as the OBBBA, which primarily combined an extension of the 2017 tax cuts and some new tax breaks with cuts to programs such as Medicaid and food stamps, is the most significant piece of legislation this administration has passed. As recently as June, a news release by Republican House Minority Whip Tom Emmer of Minnesota touted the bill as the single greatest victory for working families in history. The bill figures to play a key role in this fall's pivotal contest to control Congress. But even some Republicans say what should have been the party's major accomplishment is looking more like a liability ahead of November's midterms. With Democrats predicted to win a majority in the House and possibly in the Senate, voters are hearing two very different descriptions of the legislation that's affected millions of Americans. Democrats are hammering the health care cuts on the campaign trail. Republicans are focused on the tax relief. Even there, the GOP might be losing the messaging war, as Democrats have been highlighting that the tax cuts were larger for high income than for low income households. Jay Townsend, a Republican consultant who worked in four presidential campaigns but is not involved in any midterm campaigns this cycle, here's people saying that the bill's cuts did not help me. It helped rich people. Many of the bill's most controversial provisions, such as work requirements for people receiving Medicaid, won't go into effect until after the midterms. Democrats accused Republicans of delaying those changes to avoid the political fallout. But there are signs that some of that political fallout is already happening. A political survey in July found that nearly one in three Americans say the law has made their financial situation worse, and a poll from the same month by the left-leaning Navigator Research found that nearly half say it is making their costs go up. The law is estimated to reduce federal Medicaid spending over the next decade by nearly $1 trillion, and a handful of rural clinics have already shut down, citing future cuts. Democrats say those closures, alongside spiking health care premiums, have given their candidates a strong issue to use against Republicans on the campaign trail. From what I can tell, nearly every Democratic challenger is using the health care cuts against Republican incumbents, and in most cases with significant effect, says Jeff Guerin, the president of Heart Research, a Democratic research and polling organization. There's very little Republicans can do at this point to mitigate the damage. Republicans passed the bill in July 2025 without Democratic support. It extended tax cuts passed during Mr. Trump's first term in 2017 and added temporary tax deductions for groups such as seniors and workers receiving tips. Republicans such as Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa called it a recipe for economic success. On the campaign trail, many Republicans are touting the bill's benefits, labeling Democrats as the party that rejected tax cuts. Sometimes the candidates point to the bill, sometimes to specific provisions within it. Representative Darren LaHood of Illinois recently mentioned a barber who is benefiting from tax relief on tips, but he also credited the, quote, tax bill broadly with helping businesses across his district. The Republican Party has a very clear difference for America, and that is always lower taxes, always American workers first, Representative Brian Mast of Florida told CNBC earlier this month. But even as Republicans paint them as would-be tax hikers, Democrats have fastened on to a different part of the bill, changes made to Medicaid and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. The OBBBA set new work requirements for people receiving Medicaid, cut federal help for states that expanded the program, and ended eligibility for some legal immigrants. Meanwhile, SNAP enrollment dropped by 11% between July 2025 and April 2026 after the law narrowed exemptions and raised the work requirement age. Americans can expect to see a lot of ads about the Medicaid cuts leading up to the midterm, says Mr. Guerin. Medicaid? Gutted, says a May video ad run by Democratic Representative Greg Glansman of Ohio against his opponent Eric Conroy, who is not a member of Congress but has expressed support for the OBBBA. Republicans are pushing back, saying the cuts are helping the nation's fiscal position by eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse, by tightening eligibility, and closing what they call loopholes in how states share costs. Still, the party's messaging has downplayed the Medicaid provisions. Instead, Republicans emphasize the tax changes, which saved American taxpayers an average of just over $2,200 per filer, according to the Nonpartisan Tax Foundation. The Treasury Department says more than 53 million taxpayers claim things like a new tip deduction and an enhanced deduction for seniors. But Mr. Guerin says that many voters are being hit by the loss of enhanced health care subsidies and fear losing their health insurance altogether. Those subsidies expired at the end of 2025 and are not directly related to the OBBBA, though Republicans could have used the bill to pass an extension. Democrats shut down the government last year over the issue, but eventually agreed to reopen it without winning any concessions. The bill has been controversial from the start. At the time of the OBBBA's passage, it faced widespread criticism from Democrats. A July 2025 Quinnipiac poll found that 44% of Americans thought the bill would hurt rather than help them personally. The same month, longtime GOP strategist Karl Rove predicted on Fox News that the bill could pose problems for his party in the next round of elections. I think it'll have a huge impact on 2026 because, remember, as these changes, particularly the Medicaid changes, come into effect, people are going to be losing their coverage, said Mr. Rove. Just weeks after the bill's passage, President Trump and congressional Republicans tried to rebrand it, pivoting from the Great Big Beautiful Bill and instead calling it the Working Families Tax Cuts Act. While voters might hold more negative than positive views of the legislation, failure to extend the tax cuts could have posed its own political challenges for Republicans. Polls also show widespread confusion about what's actually in the bill. In the July Politico poll, about 2 in 5 voters say they had heard of the law but couldn't explain its features. In a separate survey by Winning the Issues, part of the GOP-aligned Winston Group, almost half of U.S. voters did not think the bill prevented a tax increase on them and their families. That was a key part of Republican messaging as they campaigned to pass the bill last year. We've seen some Republicans running ads calling this essentially a tax cut, but that's not how people feel, says Julie Alderman Boudreau, the director of research at left-leaning Navigator Research. This bill is a huge liability for any Republican on the ballot in 2026. And once again, this particular article was by Caitlin Babcock, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Moving on to our second headline from today's USA section of The Monitor, it reads, Restocking U.S. missile interceptors will take years. China and Russia are watching. America's stockpile of key defensive missiles is low because of the Iran war. Production is expected to ramp up, but the shortage is challenging the U.S. military. The date on this article is August the 17th. It is by Anna Mulring Grobe, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. U.S. stockpiles of some of America's key defensive missiles have been seriously depleted, some estimates say by more than two-thirds, since the Iran war began in February. It will take years to replace them, say analysts, who add that the shortage could embolden U.S. rivals such as China and Russia. General Dan Kane, the Pentagon's top officer, warned the White House about potential shortages of Patriot and other missiles weeks before it decided to attack the Iranian regime, news articles at the time noted. More recently, President Donald Trump has reportedly demanded answers from Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth about the shortages, which are already influencing how the United States conducts war. The White House called off attacks against Iran due to concerns about troop defense, given the depletion of interceptor stocks, the New York Times and Wall Street Journal reported. Publicly, however, President Trump has continued to say that the U.S. has massive amounts of missiles. He also threatened to prosecute treasonous leakers. In response, retired Marine Corps Colonel Mark Cassian, who has conducted widely cited studies tracking depleted U.S. missile stockpiles, says that his numbers came from public records, not leaks. A defense analyst with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, Mr. Cassian, also says that he's ready to show the work that went into his reports. If two analysts at a Washington think tank can come up with these numbers, he says, then the Chinese government, with tens of thousands of intelligence officials and way more sources of information, can come up with the same numbers. So, what is the current situation with the U.S. missile stockpiles? Patriot missiles are valuable because they are versatile from a military perspective, designed to handle relatively low-flying threats, ranging from incoming missiles to drones and aircraft, and leaving the more specialized THAAD system to defend against high-flying, faster missiles. These Patriot stockpiles are down about 65% since the U.S. and Israel launched their war against Iran, according to the CSIS study, co-written by Mr. Cassian, and based on budget materials and publicly released information. The exact numbers are classified, but by these estimates, there are fewer than 850 Patriots left in America's arsenal. To defend U.S. forces stationed at bases in the Middle East from more high-flying Iranian ballistic missiles, which are harder to intercept, the U.S. has THAAD, that's Terminal High Altitude Area Defense Missiles. Since the war began, analysts estimate that supplies of those are down by anywhere from about 50% by CSIS's count to some 80% as cited in a widely circulated CNN report. So what are U.S. options for filling the shortages? The U.S. is taking several major steps to boost its missile stockpiles. It has a $58 billion seven-year contract with Lockheed Martin to help increase Patriot missile production from roughly 620 to 2,000 a year. Under another $35 billion contract, the defense contractor is also slated to ramp up THAAD missile production from 96 to some 400 per year over 7 years. The Pentagon said Friday that it is increasing production of ship-fired SM-3 interceptor missiles designed to take out ballistic missiles, which form the backbone of naval defenses, according to a Pentagon statement. We are stabilizing our supply chains, expanding munitions production, and putting our entire defense industrial base on a wartime footing, says Michael Duffy, Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Sustainment. While the administration has pushed back on reports that U.S. missile defense stockpile is low, it has used the alarm surrounding them to drive up Pentagon spending requests, some analysts note. That has prompted concerns about the growing number of no-bid contracts beneficial to big defense corporations and the political donors who run them. Brokers representing President Trump bought millions in defense sector shares during 2025 public records show. The following year, the government awarded Lockheed Martin the Patriot and THAAD contracts. Mr. Trump's trades were made under a blind arrangement in which brokerage firms are prohibited from accepting direct trade requests from the president or his family. In the meantime, President Trump said at a NATO summit in Ankara, Turkey last month that he was considering granting Ukraine a production license to allow it to use Patriot technology to build missile parts locally. Weeks later, however, Mr. Trump appeared to walk back the offer. So what could this mean for the wars in Iran and Ukraine? For the U.S., the problem is less about an immediate shortage of missiles, since about one-third or half of the arsenal remains, and more about what it portends for future conflicts, analysts say. The risk comes from U.S. adversaries, particularly China, as well as North Korea and Russia, which could view the depleted U.S. stockpile as a window of opportunity to attack American allies at a time when the nation's defenses are already stretched. This is already playing out in countries like Ukraine, says Luke Coffey, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. Aware that the scarce Patriot missile is the main weapon capable of effectively and consistently intercepting Russian ballistic missiles, the Kremlin has put its own missile production into high gear to try to exploit Kyiv's shortages. Its ballistic missile strikes on Ukraine have climbed steadily from 61 in April to 198 in July, according to the Institute for the Study of War. European countries like Spain have stockpiles of interceptors that could be transferred to Ukraine with little risk, Mr. Coffey adds. And not all munitions are in short supply, but those that are more plentiful come with trade-offs for conflicts like the current war in Iran, including shorter ranges that could require U.S. military forces to fly over enemy territory. That, Mr. Kansian warns, could result in greater vulnerability for American troops and potentially greater losses. And once again, this particular article was by Anna Mulring-Grobe, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. With that, we're going to jump over to the editorial section and pick up an editorial for you. The headline reads, Afghans cling to education for girls. After 5 years of harsh restrictions by the Taliban regime, fathers, mothers, and daughters across Afghanistan hold fast to the vision of unlocking independent inquiry and thinking through schooling. The date on this particular editorial is August the 17th, and it is, of course, by the Monitor's editorial board. 5 years ago this month, as the last United States forces withdrew from Afghanistan, the Taliban grasped the reins of government and have kept a tight hold on them since. The group's harsh interpretation of Islamic rules excludes girls and women who make up half of Afghan's estimated 50 million people from any meaningful education or employment opportunities beyond primary school. Such limitations affect untold individuals and families, as well as the overall development of a country mired in decades of civil war and foreign occupation. Yet, even amid a system likened to gender apartheid, Afghanistan's girls and women refuse to be completely cowed. They tune in to sessions on the radio or the internet when it works. Some, whose families can afford it, attend clandestine informal schools in neighborhood homes. Others read and reread the same textbooks that they or their siblings used in pre-Taliban years when girls could attend secondary school and even university. I'm studying in an online school, and we have lost ourselves. And we have not lost ourselves, one girl told researchers during a survey recently completed by Georgetown University's Institute for Women, Peace, and Security. I'm an Afghan girl, full of light, full of knowledge, full of power. They can close the school, but they can never extinguish the science from my mind, she declared. Her assertion of individuality, intelligence, and independent thought is drawing support at home and abroad in ways that are both quiet and quietly transformative. Last week, Agence France-Presse reported on conversations with Afghan fathers, many of them religiously observant, who chafe at the limits on their daughters' learning. The news agency described these men as losing sleep over what to do to help their bright and frustrated daughters and noted that 9 out of 10 believe in the importance of girls' education. Culture and religion are often used as an excuse by extremists, according to Malala Yousafzai, girls' education campaigner and Nobel Peace Prize laureate. But the religion that I know encourages education, she said in a 2024 interview with CNN. Ms. Yousafzai, who was shot in 2012 by Taliban fighters, referred to dozens of Muslim countries where women can access education and called on their leaders to step forward and actually challenge the Taliban's ban on girl education. Countries as diverse as Morocco, Saudi Arabia, and Iran have enacted changes to traditional family laws and social restrictions over the past several decades. Girls and women's rights to a full and fulfilling education has not always been a given, but it has been successfully claimed the world over. While the situation in Afghanistan is dire, it need not be dispiriting or hopeless. In the Georgetown survey, 80% of Afghan women said they were focused on supporting girls' education, viewing it as central to personal empowerment and eventually political peace. As an activist woman, I am not a victim of war, but an architect of social peace, one respondent told the researchers. And this is a voice that must be heard globally. And again, that is a commentary by the Monitor's editorial board. With that, I'm afraid we have run out of time for today. As always, I appreciate you taking time out of your day to spend some time with me listening to a variety of articles from the Christian Science Monitor. Stay safe, stay well, stay hopeful, and I'll be back with you with more from the Christian Science Monitor at the end of this week. Thank you for listening.